Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig, and we're not quite sure what you call today's program, but you can figure it out. We have a lineup of, I would say, appealing, and yummy foods.
And interesting, and not necessarily things you'd kind of expect to find on your bookshelf, but
it's not fine dining. It's not.
Every author has a fascinating take on an interesting subject, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy. And first up,
a real gentleman
and a scholar.
A really, really nice guy who also is a remarkable researcher. I mean, he put so much research into this book.
Well, why don't we just listen to him, since he did?
Yes, listen to Adrian Miller.
Well, an interesting subject, soul food, and an interesting author, Adrian Miller, who is a writer, attorney. You said you're a certified barbecue judge?
That's right. Certified barbecue judge with the Kansas City Barbecue Society.
Well, no, that's an awesome society. We lived in Kansas City for a while.
Aren't they the ones who do the French fry rating?
The French fry ratings?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know about that. I haven't heard about that.
Somebody used to do that, and Arthur Bryant's near the old baseball stadium.
Oh, right.
Was always on that list.
Okay.
They swore there that they had never, ever cleaned the barbecue pit.
It was a badge of honor, right?
something like that, and I'll bet you know some places like that, too.
Yep.
Well, anyhow, tackle this. Now, you say that you were raised in suburban Denver in an African-American family, but in suburban Denver, you were raised on soul food. I find that so unlikely. Having lived in the Midwest, you know, having lived in Kansas City and Leawood, Kansas, I just can't even imagine it.
Well, so I grew up with two Southern parents. They're transplants from the South, so my mom's from Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Yeah.
And my dad is from Helena, Arkansas, which is in the Delta part of Arkansas.
Wow.
They actually came from different places and met in Denver and stayed there. And my mom's a really good cook, so she would make other cuisines. We would have American food, Italian food, Mexican food, and other things. But most regularly, we got Southern food and soul food. And it was really on Thanksgiving and New Year's Day that it really expressed itself.
It certainly was what resonated with you the most, because you admitted before we started this interview that even though you wrote this book in a couple of years, you've been pondering the possibilities and how to approach it for more than a decade. Now, why is that?
It was mainly because of another book I read by John Edgerton called Southern Food, At Home, In History, and On the Road. In that book, he said that the tribute to black cooks has yet to be written. And now, he wrote that book in the late 80s. I was reading it around the year 2000, and I just thought that was interesting. So I emailed Mr. Edgerton and just asked him, hey, you wrote this book several years ago. Do you still think this is true? And he said, yeah, for the most part, people have dealt with parts of the subject, but nobody's really taken it head on. So with no qualifications other than eating the food, I said, oh, I could do that. And that started me on the journey.
And you about it. 12 or 13 years later, you finally finished?
Finally finished it. Because the project has changed, because when I first started, I read that we talk about the cooks, cuisine, and the culture all in one volume. And thanks to all of the sources out there, digitized information on the internet, I have enough to write several books. So I had to kind of change my tack, and I thought, well, let me write about soul food, because that's the most identifiable part of African-American cuisine, and that could be an introduction that could lead me to other things.
Talk about the term soul food. You go to some trouble to define it, describe where it's most commonly executed, which is some rather unusual places, as I recall from reading the book.
Yeah, so because I think there's a lot of confusion between soul food and Southern food, because there is considerable overlap in terms of the ingredients and the dishes prepared. So what I tell people is that soul food is one of the traditional cuisines for African Americans. The other ones are kind of the coastal areas of the low country of the Carolinas and the Creole food of the lower Mississippi Valley and the Chesapeake Bay area. But soul food really traces its roots to the kind of the interior South, what is often called the Deep South, where cotton was grown. The stretch of low-lying land that goes from the Virginia and western Carolinas all the way through Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and eastern Arkansas, and as well as eastern Texas. And it's the food that those people living there took to other parts of the country when they left the South and tried to replicate their diet.
And it slides by low country cuisine, which you get in South Carolina, and it slides by Creole cuisine and Cajun cuisine as you get it in New Orleans, so it misses out on those.
Yeah, and there's some common threads there in terms of common ingredients, but it really is a more distinctive kind of cuisine, and I think it really is about what foods people took to other parts of the country and tried to replicate in those new environments.
Now, is it also part of the roots, if you like, that, that people had before they moved?
Yes, yes. So in some senses, it was their everyday fare. But a lot of what we know of in terms of soul food was really the special occasion food that they ate in the South. So, for instance, fried chicken. Fried chicken is something that's commonly eaten now, but 100 years ago and more, it was a special occasion food, something you really only had maybe in the spring, maybe on a Sunday, and maybe on a holiday. So that is a signature soul food item, but it really was something rare in the past.
Well, you could define the soul food by specific ingredients, because that's how you organize your book.
Mm-hmm.
You have a chapter on each particular ingredient, such as a chapter on fried chicken and a chapter on, what's another one here?
Chitlins.
Chitlins.
That's a tough chapter to read through. If you're a little squeamish, listeners, slide by that paragraph.
The one that got me, that got my attention, was possum.
that too.
Yeah.
That too. I guess that's hard to replicate because it's hard to find a good possum anymore.
Right, right.
They don't have possum at Whole Foods.
No, they don't. At least not yet.
They may, huh? And look at Peru. The national dish is a guinea pig.
Yeah. Well, my idea with doing that, thought it would be easiest to kind of explain the history, because I didn't want to write a drowsy history, so I wanted to have some fun with it. So I thought it would be best to create a representative meal, and I thought, okay, if anybody around the world was eating soul food, what are the things they're likely to have? And then I decided to write chapters about those things and explain what the food item is, how it gets on the soul plate, what it means for African-American culture, and then provide some recipes so people can get in the kitchen.
I thought some of the intro pieces at the beginning of each chapter were just really brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
How did you find those quotes?
So a lot of it was because of digitizing of old book, magazine articles, and other things. I could do word searches, so a lot of things turned up that way. I read through a lot of kind of manuscript collections, and it was just rich. And I just kept finding things. And I said, okay, I made a mental note. I need to save that for later because that's just too good of a quote.
I didn't know there was that much out there, to be perfectly honest, written down. But I'm just amazed at how much information you've packed into this book.
Yeah, one reason why I did that is because I knew that I was saying things about soul food that people hadn't contemplated before or would be controversial. And so I figured I'd better back it up, because I know somebody's going to call me on some of these things.
Yeah, how about red Kool-Aid? You got to be kidding.
That's the official soul food drink.
There's a picture of them in the back with a mason jar filled with red Kool-Aid.
Exactly.
Well, I never would have thought of that one. I mean, I've gone to soul food restaurants and never seen that.
No. Oh, yeah. No, in some restaurants, it's actually, there's a prominent display of a red Kool-Aid picture.
The other thing you did is you incorporated a set of exercises for the strengthening of the fingers and the wrist and the elbow. In order to find out more about this topic, you have to go from the numbered footnote all the way to the end and then all the way back again.
Right, you got to do a little workout after you eat that food, you know.
Tell me, how's this book getting reception-wise? I mean, you said right at the start that you picked these specific foods for this meal, and right away everybody had a criticism. And I think the funniest one was the lady with the neck bones.
Oh, yeah. Because, you know, I like to make my elders happy. So when an older woman is just like, how dare you not include neck bones? You know, that made me a little nervous. But I have to tell you, people have been very excited about the book. They like the way it's organized. The first printing has already sold out, and the book doesn't actually come out until the 15th.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So it's been getting an enthusiastic reception.
Well, I guess people really want to know.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, and there's a lot in here that just people don't know, and I think that the word is getting out about it's a new look at soul food.
Oh, I mean, there's plenty that I don't know. I mean, truly.
Yeah, yeah.
And we spend a lot of time in the South because our kids live.
Oh, okay.
So, and then some of our best friends here are from Kentucky.
Oh, all right.
And that's a hoot, too, because they're from Cadiz.
Cadiz, just like they spelled in Spain. except they don't know how to pronounce it.
Okay.
And they make the largest pot you've ever seen of black-eyed peas
for New Year's.
So I guess there's a superstition there.
Well, isn't Edgerton from Cadiz?
I have no idea.
I think Edgerton.
I don't know. I
can't remember if it's Edge or Edgerton.
I get him mixed up with John Edge. He's from Oxford, Mississippi.
Right. Oh, yeah, John T. Edge. Yep, great friend. He's very knowledgeable on Southern food, yeah.
But these friends of ours, they have major oral battles. They come from opposite side of some hill down there. On what is that dish?
Well, Lon's from Louisville, and Marcy's from Cadiz.
Cadiz.
Or Cadiz, I can't stop myself from saying it that way.
No, it's Cadiz.
And they each have their own set of cooking pots.
They won't
use the other person's.
Wow, it's that intense, huh?
It's really intense. But is that soul food? Not really.
Well, I don't know. They make some funny things.
Yeah, I guess they have some soul food ingredients.
They're not run of the mill stuff. They make black eyed peas, that's for sure.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I think you're hitting on kind of one of the areas of confusion, because you'll see white Southerners making some of the same dishes.
Yeah.
And one difference I point out is that soul food tends to be more intense in terms of the seasoning. Spice level is usually higher, and one difference that I've seen in kind of same dishes being prepared by different people from the South.
And with that, what is that dish they make? Boogaloo? Is there something called burgaloo?
There is
one. Oh, burgoo?
Burgoo.
Yeah, that's a stew that's often served with barbecue. I think that's a Kentucky thing mainly.
Yeah,
okay,
because
battles over that one.
Over the burgoo.
But I just, your book is also witty. I want everybody to understand that it's dense but not heavy and boring. I mean, you have these chapters called How Did Macaroni and Cheese Get So Black?
That's one of my favorite titles.
I think you had your tongue firmly planted in your cheek throughout the whole project.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because I wanted to have fun with it. Because, again, I didn't want to write a plodding history that would make people fall asleep. Because there's just so much fun stuff out there. I just wanted people to get a window of that.
You're in the queue of books I'm going to read cover to cover, Adrian Miller. And I guess if I read it fast, as long as I don't take too much time on the footnotes, I might have finished it by the time you come out with your next book.
Yeah, you might. And I have an idea what that next book's going to be.
I say you've enjoyed this experience, I guess, huh?
Yes, it was a lot of fun, and it's very gratifying to see that people are interested in the topic, because one of the premises of my book is that soul food is largely misunderstood and maligned, so I'm just glad that people are willing to take another look at it.
Well, I think you did a great job of doing it.
I think so, too.
Now, I have a totally off the subject of soul food question for you.
Okay.
Since you used to work for President Bill, here's the question. Is Hillary going to run in 2016?
Oh, I think absolutely. As long as her health is good, I think she's in.
Yeah, I think so, too. We were talking about it yesterday, but unfortunately the person I was talking to about is a Republican.
Oh.
Well, you know, I'm planning to run for president, too. I want to follow the Herman Cain model, because my next book should be out by that time.
Oh.
So I think, you know.
Herman didn't do so well.
but he got notoriety for his book.
No, I mean, he did a decent job when he was running the Restaurant Association,
I thought.
He was president of the National Western Association. I thought he did a good job for that. Why? What changed? I guess.
I think running for president can bring out the worst in you.
I think it did.
Yeah. it's a rough thing to go through.
Whereas Adrian's all ready to go.
Adrian, yes.
Miller in 2020.
Yeah, there you go.
You heard it here first. Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us today,
Adrian. This has been fun, and thank you for a wonderful book.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me on your show.
And we'll be back with a definitive cookbook on one of America's favorite dishes, burgers, coming up right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and next up, the most singularly unlikely of the barbecue kings, since they come from New England. They are indeed, however, barbecue kings. I'm talking about Andy Husbands and Chris Hart, and we'll be talking to Chris Hart about their latest venture, Wicked Good Burgers. And this is a book you think you know all about, and you will be amazed. Wicked, wicked, wicked. You are wicked, Chris Hart. We're sitting looking at your latest book. I guess we've covered all of them, but this one's Wicked Good Burgers, And I don't know if it's a different photographer or if I'm just particularly hungry, but I am just drooling. These are the most luscious looking burgers I've ever seen.
Our good friend Ken Goodman took the photos in this book and did a fantastic job. And do our best to write great recipes. And when you do that, often the food looks great too.
Okay, so it's called Wicked Good Burgers. And it's you, Chris Hart, with Andy Husbands. And Andrea was writing on with you?
Yeah, Andrea wrote one of the recipes, a variety of the recipes, and added her writing expertise to much of the book. And Andy and I have been friends since high school and have just explored food in all different directions over the years. And past year we landed on burgers, and this is the result.
Yes, and you have every conceivable kind of burger in this book with all the recipes for the accompaniments, as well as the rolls, and carrying it further to the sides, which I thought was fascinating, too. Like
yep.
Salt, vinegar, potato chips, which is something everybody... And not to mention ginger beer floats. Desserts, right?
Yeah, in particular, we got into milkshakes, which in our book we referred to fraps, which in the New England area, particularly right outside Boston, a milkshake is only called a frap. And so we have a bunch of frap recipes in the book. And you can choose to have them regularly, or they go very well with bourbon as well.
Well, I've never, ever, ever seen a dessert burger. We have one of those in here, too.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. That was kind of a fun thing we did at the end. We said, we don't have many desserts in here, so let's create a dessert burger.
And, it's cute. It has chocolate sauce instead of ketchup.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyhow, tell us, what kind of fun did you have doing your research?
Yeah, so I think that wrote Wicked Good Barbecue last, which was a very ambitious competition-level barbecue book. And folks, many, many folks really enjoyed reading it, and there's intense barbecue people that enjoy cooking out of it, but kind of the everyday backyard cook, sometimes it was a bit more of a project. Many of those recipes could take a day, 2 days, or a whole weekend, and it is what it is. And we said to ourselves, well, we want to write another book. What, maybe we could try to focus on something that maybe is maybe a bit more accessible to a wider audience. And we thought back to, where did we start with cooking outdoors? And that was burgers. I think that's where many people start, is cooking on a grill in a park for your family. And we wanted to both show straightforward ways of improving burger cookery and then kind of doing the wicked thing, which is layering on unexpected flavors and kind of making it a bit over the top. And that's what motivated us for this book, and we're pretty happy with the result.
Now, you started out with Wicked Barbecue, and you really were wicked. And as I said before we came on the air, I'm surprised nobody firebombed your respective dining establishments, because you pointed out to everybody that two Yankees from Boston had become the de facto champions of barbecue in the South.
Yeah.
Which is, isn't it the Jack Daniel's barbecue competition that you won?
Indeed. We won the World Championship of Barbecue at Jack Daniel's down in Tennessee a few years ago. And all the Southerners were very polite about it. There's no uproar. There's no firebombings. They may not have been very happy when we drove out of town with the trophy, but they were very polite about it and shook our hands and wished us the best.
And they tried harder next year, right?
Yes. Yes, indeed.
Have you re-entered that competition, or are you...
We have. Yeah, I've actually been at that competition the last 11 years in a row. The way that you get to that competition is you win a state championship. So we go around and we cook in our region and in Maine and Vermont, all the Northeast states. And if you win a state championship, invited to the World Championship in Tennessee against the 50 or 60 best cooks in the country.
Now, give us an idea of the structure of people are going to find in this book. Anne mentioned that it's really very complete all the way through milkshakes and dessert.
And the condiments. I mean...
Yeah, that was the point. I was going to ask...
About the best mayo ever?
Yeah, I was going to have them talk about them. Exactly.
Yeah, so one of the key things with pretty much any type of cooking, when you're cooking a protein, barbecue or burgers, fried chicken, whatever it is, in this case burgers, the condiments don't save you, right? You have to be able to cook a delicious burger that, with nothing much more than salt and pepper and maybe a little smear of a condiment on it, is delicious. That has to be the starting point. If you have a dry burger, if you have a crumbly burger, if you have an overcooked burger, if you have a steam burger, if it's not cooked well, the condiments in the book won't help. So that's where we start in the book, is how to create a perfect burger. And what are some of the attributes of a perfect burger? A perfect burger is well-seasoned. A perfect burger has a nice crust on the exterior. Perfect burger kind of explodes with juice when you bite into it. You need all these things. A perfect burger tastes like beef. So when we have all these things, and that's where we start in the book, well, from there, we can add mayo and fried oysters and all these other wicked toppings and kind of extend it. Really emphasize what it takes to cook a great burger first.
Now, you have a couple of tips in here. One of them in particular is that you chill the meat before you start working with it.
Correct.
And that's just because that makes the texture so much better?
Right. Is one of the things we really recommend doing in the book is to grind your own meat. And you could do that with a KitchenAid, with an attachment. You can buy one relatively inexpensively at places like Williams-Sonoma or Kitchen Gadget Store. And it's really, it's stunning. The difference, if you go to the market and you buy a piece of chuck and then you grind it at home properly and season it with salt and cook it on the hot grill, it's just fantastic. And the grinding it yourself makes such a difference. It's kind of the same reason, like, if you're into coffee, why do you grind your coffee beans freshly before you make it? It's the same idea. Buying frozen pre-made patties is kind of the coffee equivalent of buying a can of pre-ground coffee, right? So it's very similar to that. And one of the reasons we like to chill it is the home grinders, one of the problems with them is they get a bit too hot. And when the grinder gets too hot, it separates the fat. The fat kind of starts to liquefy it a little bit, and the fat separates from the protein. And when the fat separates from the protein, when you cook it, all the fat will come out of the burger, and you'll have a dry, crumbly burger. So we don't want to do that. And so the way to deal with that is when you maybe using a KitchenAid or maybe an inexpensive grinder that like a lot of home cooks may have, is make everything very, very cold. Not frozen, but close to it. So you put the little grinder attachment in the freezer. You put your meat in the freezer just for 30 minutes so it gets cold. And then when you grind it, it just grinds nice and clean. And all the fat and the protein are still emulsified together. And then when you cook it, it stays juicy.
That's
so
amazing.
That grinding is kind of where we start in our book as a really highly recommended first step to making a great burger.
Now, did somebody tell you that or did you discover that?
Well, we knew that just from years of being around people that cook meat and going into restaurants, and we just kind of knew that, but we explored it for sure on our own. And there are shortcuts. For instance, here's a good shortcut is walk into your meat market and pick up a piece of chuck and hand it to them and say, can you grind this for me? And just get it ground right in the market on the spot with the meat to your spec. So that's a good thing to do. Another important part of grinding is actually food safe, right?
Oh,
is
yeah.
If you have ground meat that's sitting in a butcher's room or in even a cellophane pack with maybe a small hole in it that you didn't realize, is that every bit of that ground meat's exposed to the air. And you can get a little bits of bacteria or things that maybe you don't want to eat on it. When you have a whole roast, the only exposure you have is to the exterior. And so there's much less chance of getting some things on the meat, particularly we'd like to keep it rare or medium rare. So self-grinding is actually kind of a food safety step as well. So if you really got like a really rare burger, I recommend grinding it yourself.
And not only that, but you just don't know how well they've cleaned the grinder in some of these places and what's gone through before.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I used to watch when we used to have a private butcher shop, I used to watch that and wonder.
Yeah.
What else is in there?
Anne mentioned earlier on that you were making burgers out of beef, but in fact you have recipes for making burgers out of all other kinds of meat too,
and even some
non-meat proteins.
Yeah, we definitely went off and explored many different types of proteins. The key element in every recipe is fat content. So we want fat involved when we make a burger. Fat's not bad. Fat's flavorful. And for instance, for our salmon burger, we like to use the salmon belly. So if you look at a fillet of salmon, the thinner bottom part of that fillet of salmon is the belly. It usually has some whiteness to it. Someone at a fish case is more than willing to sell that to you. They'd be thrilled to slice off the belly and sell you the belly. That makes just a stunning, stunning salmon burger. And one of the main reasons is fat.
Fat.
Go ahead.
Right. Now, obviously, you talk about the belly. We've been getting swordfish belly. I never see it anywhere except at the meat counter and Whole Foods.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, at the fish counter.
Sure.
Then why is it so restricted in availability, or what?
I think it's just more of a choice of the folks that are running the fish case to highlight it. No, I think that things like belly, often many people that are at that fish case ask them to cut it off. So can I have, they don't even know what they're asking for, but can I have the prime cut there? Mm-hmm. And they ask them to trim the edges off. And the edges is actually probably something like the belly. That has a lot of fat and whiteness in it.
Yeah, we get that.
Yeah, I personally think that that's the best part.
You could make a killer burger out of that.
You could indeed. You could indeed. But you got to think about, it doesn't matter what protein it is, a burger is indulgent, right? A burger is when you bite into it, you get your shirt dirty. It's juicy and it kind of exploding, and it's an indulgent experience. And so you can use lots of different proteins. But for us, in order to be a true burger, it needs to be that experience. It can't be dry. It can't be too lean. It needs to be indulgent. And we all need to watch our health and whatnot. And my recommendation would be maybe we don't have one every night, but
exactly.
We have one every week or a couple times a month or something like that. Don't cut back on the fat on your burger. Maybe just cut back on the number you make.
Now, tell us about $100 burger. Tell our listeners about that.
That was Andy's invention. We did that back in Wicked Barbecue with the $100 meatloaf, being a very...
Oh, yeah, I remember
We very everyday dish and kind of elevating it with foie gras and duck and other things like that. And that's what we did with this one, is duck and lobster and truffle. Uh-huh. And then one of the key ingredients was actually caul fat, which, again, adds that kind of juicy, fatty element to the dish. It wasn't a great part of our budget until we had a testing budget, and it kind of blew that out. But other than that, it was a fun time.
I bet you didn't throw those out after they were photographed.
We did not.
You didn't do that. It's funny, when I buy tuna at Whole Foods, I have this joke with one of the guys in particular behind the counter who always seems to manage to cut the piece of tuna quite a lot bigger than I want it.
Yes.
And then he trims it off, and guess where that goes? They cook it for themselves in the back.
Probably.
No, they do.
Or it just looks so beautiful. You ask for a pound, you get a pound and a quarter, and it looks so beautiful sitting there. You say, oh, I'll just take the pound and a quarter.
Yeah, that's true. Well,
that's what I do.
That's what we did last night, and there was some left over lunch today. Now,
which is already gone.
Now, how about a sous vide burger?
The sous vide burger is fun. One of the things about the sous vide burger is what we're trying to do is create perfect doneness throughout the entire burger. So if you have a really hot grill and you put a burger on it and then finish it, I think when you bite into it, often what you see is the exterior is done, well done, and then as we start getting into the center, we get kind of closer to our desired rareness. And with a sous vide burger, what we're able to do is we take the meat and we vacuum seal it and we put it in a bath that is exactly the temperature we want. I would recommend somewhere around 100 degrees, a water bath, 120 degrees Fahrenheit. And what that does over time, after about a half an hour or so, is the entire burger from the exterior to the interior is exactly 120 degrees, or rare. And we can also infuse some flavors in that vacuum seal package. So we can put a little bit of herb, a little bit of oil, a little bit of salt and pepper, and it really infuses 100% of the meat with that flavor. And when you're ready, they can almost be held indefinitely in that bath. The bath will never exceed 120 degrees, and so the meat will never exceed 120 degrees.
I want to pass along a hint that some chef gave me in an interview, and I hadn't even considered it. Don't try sous-viding anything in your food saver kind of packaging because it'll melt.
I haven't experienced that, but
you
okay.
Used it like the vacuum seal in a food saver, a regular consumer food. Have you done that?
I have. I haven't had any problems with that.
Oh, good. All right. So I can use my food saver then.
Yeah, I think you can. It might also depend on the temperature you sous vide at.
Well, it's by definition low, right?
Low. Normally, anywhere from 100 degrees to maybe 170 degrees on the high side would be maybe our range. And we can basically... The temperature of the water is if you use a meat thermometer, if you're doing lamb or you're doing pork and you want it to be, say, 145 degrees, you'd want your water at 145 degrees because that's what you want your finishing temperature to be. And then 100% of the meat is cooked that way. And then we just need to get a really hot skillet or grill and take it out of the sous vide packaging and just hit it on that grill to give a little bit of caramelization and we're ready to go. And that's it. And it's a little fussy on the front end in terms of preparation and whatnot.
Yeah, right.
But when your guests arrive, and you can just kind of take them out and immediately put them on the grill, and within moments we can have a great burger perfectly
that's
cooked.
That's a great idea.
It's a nice trick.
Now, let's conclude with the Gold Coast burger.
Oh, yes.
Which is like a, I don't know, it's called everything on it you can possibly imagine.
Indeed.
And it looks wonderful. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I could just, oh.
I missed the fried egg on top in the photograph.
Yeah. It even
yeah,
has-
so I was out in Australia maybe 10 years ago, and I went up, drove between Byron Bay and the Gold Coast on the east coast of Australia.
Sure, we know exactly where it is.
Yeah, and stopped at a couple of different, like shacks near these surf spots and had a burger. And I was shocked to find that typical thing, some toppings were unique, to say the least. Beets, pineapple, fried egg, hot sauce, mayo. And many of them, which we didn't put this in the book, but were made not with beef like they typically are in the States, but with kangaroo.
Kangaroo, right, yeah.
And quite rare, even close to raw in the center with the kangaroo. Blue, black and blue kind
yeah,
of
a right.
approach to the meat. And I was certainly impressed and brought that idea to the book.
Now, one last thing to say on that is don't wear clean clothes when you're eating it.
Absolutely. That's the mark of a good burger. You get dirty. You get messy.
You get really messy with the soft fried egg on top.
Yeah. Indeed. You get a little bit of egg dripping. You get some juices dripping.
You could go with anything but the pineapple. I never understood this pineapple thing that they put on pizza, too.
Well, you can always say you don't want it. Hold the pineapple.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Chris, this is a really wonderful contribution to the iconic burger, and more so. You even have a good poutine recipe in here.
Yeah, so, for sure. Yeah. You know, we hang out in northern New England often, up in Burlington, Vermont, and then we go across to Montreal, and we get into poutine quite often. And it's just another one of those indulgent dishes.
Oh, yeah, don't have it regularly.
works quite well. An evening of poutine and burgers is a good evening, though may require some exercise in the morning.
Well, I can't imagine what's going to be wicked good coming out next, but be sure to come back and talk to us again when you've decided what it is.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, wish we could see you.
Let's do it soon. Come to Boston. We'll take you out.
Great.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And, you know, I think what we've been talking about really are comforting foods that you think you know all about and you really don't. Next up is a sort of a sentimental favorite. It's called Leon, which is one of Peter's favorite chains, small family chains in England. And his family and friends, we're going to talk to K. Plunkett Hogg, right? Did
right.
I get that right?
I'm not sure, but I think you're close.
Okay.
Here she is. K. Plunkett Hogg, welcome to On the Menu, calling us all the way from my native land. We hope the weather is nice in London today, but it probably isn't.
No, very cloudy, but quite warm, so we can't complain.
Okay, and cookbook we're going to be talking about today is very much a family affair, but it's a family affair associated with a chain of restaurants called Leon. Now, we interviewed Benny at Leon years ago. I don't think we ever asked him why you chose the name Leon. And why such a family thing?
Well, the name Leon, the co-founders of Leon restaurant chain are Henry Dimbleby, John Vincent, and Allegra McCavity. And they started Leon about 8 or 9 years ago now. And the chain is actually named after John Vincent's father, who is called Leon. And the family appeal, I believe, came from the fact that Henry and John had been traveling and realized that they couldn't get any decent, healthy fast food. They were just getting fat on burgers and bad sandwiches. So they thought they could create a family-friendly restaurant where you could get healthy, fast food that was good for everybody and enjoyable for the whole family. So that's how the concept came about.
Now, you have that, and you have in your chain of restaurants, what is now a chain, how many?
I think there are 11 now. I don't actually work full-time
right.
chain. I work as a consultant for them and also wrote Family and Friends with John and have a great relationship with him and Henry. But I believe they have 11 and it's growing. And
right.
fingers crossed, you know, it would be lovely if we could expand over the pond. It would be marvelous. But that's a question for them, really.
Yeah, well, he said, you know, his secret plan, which is not so secret, is to have it global.
So it would be wonderful. I mean, it's a great chain of restaurants. I mean, I enjoy it tremendously. Every time I'm in town, I definitely pop in for a falafel sandwich or for the great fish finger wrap, which has become very famous here.
Peter is very fond of the whole chain. As he indicated, we've eaten there and interviewed people in the past. I wanted to say right at the beginning that we get a lot of books across our desks, but only the occasional one is a book that makes you smile, and this one makes you smile.
Oh, I'm so happy. That was our aim, because I just think food is about people, and it's about enjoyment. Recipes are great, but unless you have people to enjoy them with, then I think that's half the fun, is cooking for other people and cooking with people. So if it made you smile, then that's a good thing.
Oh, your photographs are absolutely wonderful. I don't know which one would you say would characterize your approach. The one with the macaroons?
Sorry?
What about the one with the macaroons, all the heads with the macaroons?
I think the macaroon one definitely does. I think we all lived in a house for about 8 days in the middle of Wiltshire in the snow in January of last year to shoot this thing. So I think that was on about day 5 or 6, and we were starting to go a little sort of, a little bit of cabin fever was setting in. But I do think that illustrates the fun we had doing it, and I hope that comes through. We really, really did have a terrific time shooting the book and writing the book.
And the mussels, it's just adorable.
The diving into the mussels picture is great. And I like the cocktail picture too. That's at John's house. We're all dressed up in our cocktail finery. And that was the very last day. So we thought, well, we'd have our cocktails on the last day.
Now we've established that the restaurant group Leon is all about family-friendly food.
But yes.
How much of the content of the book, family-friendly food, Leon menu style, and how much is just family and family-friendly?
There's a handful of dishes in the book that are reflected in the Leon menu. The posh egg cups are on the Leon menu, quite a few of the wraps and sandwich dishes, and a lot of the salad dishes. But there's over 200 recipes in here, and with the Leon cookbooks, this is number 4. Number 5 will be out next year. We try to reflect the ethos of Leon, I think, and the fun element of it, but also put some new things in there. And I think what we try to do with this one is to put recipes in. There are a few challenging recipes, but in general, it's recipes that anyone in the family can have a go at. And I was quite adamant of having a section in there, which is 10 things you should know how to cook before you leave home.
Oh, I love that.
Because I was struck by my nephews at university spending all their money on takeaways.
Yes.
And pizza. And I was thinking, well, roast the chicken, and you can get 4 or 5 meals out of that.
Now, what, can you remember the 10?
The 10, I've got it in front of me. I'm cheating, Peter.
Well, that's all right.
I think there's roast chicken, and then from the roast chicken, we say make a chicken stock. Then from that, you can make a risotto, a chicken curry, a chicken pot pie. We've got a quick corner store curry, which is everything you can find from the 10 o'clock shop that's open late on your way home, but is quite healthy. And tin goods like chickpeas, spinach, or you can always pick up a potato or something. Make something out of that. Make a curry or a stew. There's a cheats chicken. I think, and then we did a bumper beef stew and a couple of pasta dishes and a couple of little simple stir fries. Actually, it's more than 10 stir fries and desserts. Just to arm you with a little bit of knowledge before you leave home, and so you're not wasting your money. It's nice to have a treat now and then, but it's really nice to be able to cook, and it saves you money, and it's better for you.
Now, we had chicken last night, but we had beer can chicken.
Oh, she has beer can chicken in here.
You have beer can chicken?
We have a beer can chicken. I love beer can chicken.
She calls it butt.
We have
beer can chicken. But I bet you don't have a...
No, she just has a can of something under it. So,
what did you put in it then?
We have a machine.
Not a machine. It's a pot.
Somebody designed a device.
That sounds extraordinary.
And it stores... First of all, there's a pan in the bottom where you store the beer. And then on top of that is a matching flat plate with a spike in the center.
So your chicken doesn't fall over. It sits on the spike.
Yeah, insert spike up chicken. And away.
Because the problem with this beer can chicken sometimes is it just tips over.
This is very stable. Yeah. And that's why
on the Leon website, we filmed me cooking the beer can one, and I have to say, it's not the prettiest thing when you start out with it, but it ends up nicely.
Yeah, well, the chicken always looks so smug.
It looks smug, and it always looks just a little bit, sort of a bit rude, really. So when you sort of think, well, I don't really want to focus on that too much. I sort of the camera crew, just pan away from it, really. That looks a little bit obscene.
It is a little bit like violating a chicken, no, isn't it?
It is. I don't know if I like that at all.
Okay, now, I think people might be sort of surprised to find so many, I'll call them exotic or ethnic recipes
in here for an English casual chain restaurant, but the backgrounds on both sides, yours and as well as the Leon family themselves, are so widespread. You grew up in Thailand and...
Yeah, I grew up in Thailand, my husband's from Jamaica, I lived in Los Angeles and New York, and John's wife is from Brazil, and his father's Italian. I think more and more, though, in all of our societies, Britain or America or wherever you go, we're so multicultural, all of us. And actually, if you go into Leon on any given day, you would always find something, an Indian curry, a Thai curry, a Persian salad we've had on recently, or a Middle Eastern falafel or hummus dish. So I think in London particularly, I think it's always the Brits and Londoners have always been early adopters. Uh-huh. Back in the day of the Romans, where we were sort of bringing stuff over and incorporating it into our cooking.
Yeah.
So I think that we wanted to reflect that. It's about an international family. And
when we
talk about family, it's extended family. It's so many of us live away from home now or live away from our families that our friends become extended family, and they can come from anywhere, and they do, and everywhere. And we just wanted to reflect that as well.
Now, you have another section that most people probably don't expect in your average cookbook. It's all about keeping chickens.
That's John. Yes, that's John and his chicken. John and Katie and their chickens. Yes, indeed. Yes, keeping chickens. Nothing like, not I can do here. I've only got a roof terrace in my flat here in London. But John's got a lovely big garden and chickens. And yes, he wrote that piece on it. And I think, again, more and more people here are getting allotments, keeping chickens, and trying to be a little bit sort of self-sustainable if they can be. Well, so we thought it was quite a fun thing to put in. The photos are quite fun.
Yeah, I was going to say, what about this chicken diving into the Khao Mun Gai?
Is that
a rubber chicken?
Site. In Thailand, the Khao Mun Gai stalls are always, they have...
Rubber chickens?
Chickens, they have real chickens hanging down, and sometimes rubber ones, but Anita decided that the rubber one might be quite fun. I quite like that photo. I wonder if anybody's tried that dish. I love that dish.
No, I haven't tried it yet, but I also think that your section on nutrition is so straightforward, simple, and common sense. Why doesn't everybody discuss nutrition in those terms?
I think, you're right, and I think that what you didn't want to do, we don't want to preach to people either. You don't want to tell people what they should and shouldn't do. You just want to make suggestions. People have got to make their own decisions on these things, but it's just giving people information. And I think once knowledge is power, and once you have information or knowledge about certain things, you can make informed decisions. And I think that's another thing that we were very keen to do in the book. And it's another thing to encourage you to cook at home, to say, look, it is so much better because you know what you're putting into your food. You know what you're giving your friends, your family, your children, if you're doing your cooking at home and not buying everything processed food all the time.
And remember to always involve the kids. Isn't that the truth?
Such fun with all the children on the shoot. And I think they came away from it learning something and having enjoyed themselves tremendously. A couple of them perhaps had been at the beginning a bit sort of, I'd rather be out playing ball or something. But by the end of the day, they all had a lovely time and learned something and enjoyed it. They just really enjoyed the process of cooking. The simple things.
Now, what are a couple of your real favourites?
I think my mum's prawn curry is one of my favourites because it's incredibly quick, but it gives you a really authentic taste of Thailand. And I found this recipe on a little piece of paper in my mother's kitchen after she'd passed away. So it's quite an emotional one for me.
Right.
I like some of the pies because I love a pie. What else do I like?
It sounds so simple making these pies. I don't think it's that simple making pies.
It is so. Shepherd's pie is so easy.
Oh, well, that one is, yeah. I'm not
that. Now, you probably don't include my sister-in-law's secret ingredient.
What is it?
Baked beans out of the cupboard.
Baked beans in the shepherd's pie.
Yes.
I think that might be quite a nice addition.
Oh, my God. Our son always loved Aunt Jeannie's shepherd's pie, but it mainly involves opening the cupboard to see what you've got in cans and dumping it all in.
Well, you know what? I think there's nothing wrong with that. I've often come home and thought, what's in my cupboard? Tinned food is great food. Tinned beans and pulses are terrific.
Yeah, they are, aren't they?
They really are, and they're so good for you. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. Frozen food and tinned food. Frozen vegetables and tinned vegetables.
Yeah, we found frozen chickpeas, which have certainly simplified our lives, too.
I've never seen a frozen chickpea.
No, well, I tried the fresh ones, and they were just impossible. They're so fussy to deal with.
Yeah, we can buy them. But first of all, they're very expensive. And then they're mostly pod, and then once you get out of the pod, you have to get the skin off too. So we discovered that our gourmet supermarket actually has them quick frozen, and they're really very useful.
They're not as high in sodium as the canned ones.
Well, they also save so much time.
Right, but I mean, the tinned ones are convenient, but they're very high in sodium.
And plus they're not
fresh. Exactly. You've got to make sure the sodium, that you've got to look at the salt content on all those tin things. But I think frozen peas and frozen broad beans and frozen soybeans, I've always got them in my freezer. And they're just easy.
We do too.
Just throw them in a sauce even, just straight from the freezer, heat them through, and it's beautiful.
Thank you so much for taking the time to join us today. We hope that perhaps you'll have better weather. We hope that
it's like England right here is pouring down rain. It's raining all summer.
I think I'm going to go on the terrace. We'll be able to get on the terrace for a drink of rosé at 6 o'clock, so we'll be all right.
Well, then you're going to do that very soon. Now, absolutely.
Thank you so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. And my own book is out next year, so I'll let you know when that's coming out.
What's the topic, Kay?
It's chilies, the history of the chilies around the world, the journey of the chili around the world. And recipes.
Yeah, that's Peter's favorite dish.
There's all sorts of chili recipes. So, yes, I will make sure I email you when it's coming out and let you know.
I'll get a copy sent to you for sure. And what do you think we'll have for you right after the break? We'll have a book all about the ultimate comfort food. Between now and when we come back, you see if you can guess what that is.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, if you guessed soup, you got the right answer. if you didn't get the right answer, you can still get the book, the ultimate book about soup.
Aliza Green, you're hitting airwaves at just the right time when we're all trying to figure out how sustainably to live. You have a book called The Soup Maker's Kitchen, which you just produced, which has a really nice approach to saving your scraps, making stock, and enjoying the comforts of a pot of soup. Now, what got you on this track of soup?
I guess that I've just made so many soups, and people say my soups are great. I really enjoy doing them. I've done them soup making for home, for myself, for parties, for friends, but also in a professional capacity as a chef where, like, the batches in this book are generally 3 quarts to 1 gallon, so serving somewhere between 8 and 12 portions. But I was making 30-gallon batches in my job.
Yeah.
So it was just a really interesting see the challenges of working in such large amounts. But I also think that for these days, when there's a lot of economic strain on many people, but yet we want to eat well and we don't want to be wasteful. We want to eat seasonally, and we also want to be able to make things that you can cook ahead and freeze well or have ready during the week, that soup is just the perfect thing.
Yeah, well, from your experience in restaurants, I mean, every restaurant worth its weight, I guess worth its stock, has stock on hand at all times and a variety of it, right?
Well, depending on the level of the restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I would say, a big dividing line between those that buy. Mostly what they're using is what they call bases, which are kind of a paste of very concentrated flavoring. Instead, you kind of add to or similar a bouillon cube idea. So that is very, very common. And I know years ago when one of the salesmen came and, oh, you have to have the bases for soups and for sauces. And I said, I'm not going to buy that, because there's a lot of additives and preservatives and very high in sodium. And he said, you're the only chef in Philadelphia that won't buy them. What's the matter with you? Like, he just couldn't understand
why I would be so
crazy as to want to make my own stocks.
What restaurant were you working at?
Back then, I'm talking a long time ago, was a place called Di Lulo, Ristorante Di Lulo, which was a wonderful northern Italian restaurant. I was there basically in the 80s, but me, personally, I have always, in a restaurant situation, I have always made my own stock. I wouldn't do anything else. Yeah. And people do ask me for home, how necessary is it and how important. There are many soups in this book that do not call for stock, that start with water, but there is also the part which is, this is sustainability aspect, which is start working with a lot of vegetables. You get that box from the CSA, or you can,
yeah,
you know, if you're going to the farmer's market, there's so much trim. You got the carrot tops and the celery and the onions and the mushroom stems and all kinds of ends of the potatoes and fennel, like the fennel stalk that are a little tough. Or you just build up the cores of the tomatoes. So, yes, you can make compost out of it. That's one use.
Mm-hmm.
But why wouldn't you use that to make a beautiful stock? And what I do is I just save those scraps in Ziploc bags in the freezer, and when I get a nice amount, I put it, one important thing is I always rinse them off because they get a little bit of frost on them, and that can give maybe an off flavor. So I rinse them under cold water, and then I make a vegetable stock. And then that is used, yes, I make vegetable soup using that stock, and actually many other soups starting with that base. But I also use that vegetable stock for cooking beans, for cooking grains, rice, any kind of like farro, you know, the wheat berries, barley, all those kinds of grains, they have a wonderful flavor if you use the vegetable stock to cook them.
Now, do you have recipes for making your own stocks in this book?
Yeah, the whole first chapter, that's
great,
all it
okay.
is.
All right.
And it's pretty detailed. I mean, things like one of the most delicious ones that I discovered was corn cob stock. So here you are, you know, summertime. Now, sometimes people are eating corn on the cob, but sometimes you're cutting the kernels off the cob. Well, the cobs, I freeze those cobs, and you get 8 or 10 of them. You put them in a pot, and it makes the most beautiful broth with a golden color and full of corn flavor. So then that, maybe you want to make a corn chowder with that.
Yeah, I like to nibble on those. If I have corn on the cob, I actually get the kinds that won't break your teeth, the softer ends, and chew on them. They're really good.
Yeah, they're good, right?
Yeah.
A lot of the goodness is in the cob, which you wouldn't really think about.
Yeah.
But did try to do, I have a mushroom stock, I have beef, I have all the different kinds of things. For instance, if you go to a restaurant, and all but the really high-end restaurants, French onion soup is extremely popular. All the chain restaurants, everybody's going to serve that. A lot of Americans love that, the melted cheese. I mean, who can resist melted cheese? But they're all using a beef base, like that paste that I was talking about. Nobody, is making a beef stock. So in this book where I have the beef stock, and it's, you know, inexpensive cuts of beef. They're very tough. But if you make that and you make an onion soup out of that, it's going to be the best onion soup you ever had in your life.
Now I have a question, because I used to make stocks and freeze them.
Yes.
And, you know, and then actually it was the guy who owned the French...
French Laundry?
No.
French Market.
French Market in D.C.
In Georgetown.
In Georgetown told me that to be safe, that you had to boil up those frozen stocks every month. Now, that to me is a lot of work. I can't believe it.
I don't get that. I can't think of, and I'm pretty good with the food safety stuff.
Yeah.
There is no reason that I can think of
to
boil it.
Because I'm still here and I never did it.
No. I've never done such a thing. I mean, I do always date the containers, and I try to use them up. 3 months is better.
Six months
is probably my top. Only because a home freezer isn't defrost and they freeze and defrost things. So, but as far as food safety, no. I can't think of a reason why you would have to do that. And that's a lot of work. Then you boil it, then you have to cool it, then you put it back in the freezer, then you take it out again and boil it and cool it and put it back again. Why would you do that?
Well, that's what I didn't understand at all.
Oh, well.
You know, I'm looking here. We just got a review copy in the mail of Michael Roman's book on schmaltz.
Uh-huh, right. I remember reading about that.
Yeah, and but I was thinking, my best friend growing up, her father did the cooking, and he always had a pot, ongoing chicken soup. It's probably very unhealthy on the stove. And any time we had any fat, he would just stick it in this pot. And so we always had schmaltz with our chicken soup. And you have I love the photograph of your chicken here with the little feet. But you don't have any schmaltz in there.
Well, I don't add any extra, if that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
And I'll usually pull out the fat packets, you know, like on the inside of the leg, the leg opening, there's fat pockets there, and I will keep them, and again, if you accumulate enough, then I'll cook them down and make my own schmaltz. But I don't have that in the soup, no. You can see it's pretty clear.
Yes.
And I know, I love the feet. The feet wasn't too much for you?
Oh, no, I love that. It's just, they're so artistic and beautifully arranged. I just loved it.
And that's what gives the body to the
exactly.
feet.
Exactly. Yeah, I like pig's feet, too. So, of course, you wouldn't probably like pig's feet, but I don't know, I do them, and I eat them. But you have the two most important ingredients in chicken soup, Jewish chicken soup, as far as I can tell. And anytime we have a cold, I make up this big batch, and I always put in parsnips and dill.
You have to have the dill. You must have the dill, and parsnips are, or the Hamburg parsley, the parsley root.
Right.
We tried that
once, and the recipe for using it said you had to peel it. And by the time I was done peeling it, there was hardly any celery root left. And I mean, I paid like $4 a pound for this, and I cut half of it away.
Well, yeah, but I would just scrub them. I don't think you need to peel them.
I got better advice. Subsequently, I got advice from someone like yourself who said, you don't need to cut that off. You just scrub them clean and you'll be fine.
Yeah, that's it.
By which time I've already flushed $2 down the garbage disposal.
Oh, well.
Now, you have all the classic soups in here. You also then get a little playful. I mean, I liked when you went off the main track with things like chilled melon, yogurt, and ginger soup.
Yeah, that one is really delicious. And that I actually did a class recently on blender soups. You know, don't... soups that you can make without any cooking. So I had the soup that I did, that melon soup. I did that golden tomato gazpacho. It has some saffron and also the smoked paprika, which is so delicious.
That's very good too. Yeah.
And then green gazpacho with the almonds and spinach and grapes. And that one is, I'm actually making that one for a big party coming up next weekend for 80 people.
Oh.
So I hope they like it.
Do you cater as well, then?
Well, this is actually I have a new position, opening a cafe, and through that, so I'm doing a party for that.
Oh, okay. So you're going back into the restaurant world?
Yeah, I am, and it's very exciting. It's a place that sells. It's called Material Culture, and they. Very large. They sell all kinds of artisan and handmade furnishings, rugs, artwork from around the world.
Oh.
They go out and buy all these different things from many places. And then there's art auctions here, and there's a rug gallery. So lots of different things, a yoga studio, all kinds of different
things
that are going on. It's kind of a cultural center.
Yeah, did we say it's Philadelphia? I'm not sure if we did or not, but it is in Philadelphia.
Yes, it's in Philadelphia. And so within that, we're opening a cafe and supper club. And so a challenge for me, but something I really enjoy. And it's a very good atmosphere because I love that, as you can see from the book, I love that international kind of approach.
Oh, sure.
Could it be to my detriment in my career, but I haven't really been able to stick to one cuisine. Probably, I mean, Italian more than anything because I professionally several very good Italian restaurants, and then I also studied the language, and I've been many, many times. In fact, in October, first week in October, I'm leading a culinary tour to Puglia, like the heel of the boot in southern Italy. I have one of the soups in the book is from my, when I went there just to check out everything for the tour. It's a really beautiful, simple chickpea soup with these semolina noodles in it, just flavored with garlic and rosemary. Couldn't be simpler. And that's a water soup, you know, back to the idea of no stock.
Uh-huh.
So I like that. I've done other culinary tours, and I will continue to do that.
I remember Puglia. I remember when we were there, and we were driving along this country road up towards the Gargano Peninsula, which is that thing, that knob that sort of sticks out just a little beyond Puglia.
Mm-hmm.
And you could smell the garlic. You could taste the garlic as the old gentlemen with their little appies were tootling back and forth to their plots, carrying their crop. And the air was thick with the odor of
garlic, must have been the season.
Yep.
Yeah, it's a great area, and everything is, I mean, talk about local and seasonal, it's hyper-local and hyper-seasonal, and they have, because it's a little isolated, not as much sort of modernization, so lots of beautiful heirloom beans, lots of wild plants in the markets, all the fish, I mean, there's no such thing as a farm-raised fish. I mean, you go to a seafood restaurant, and you're looking at the little boats right offshore that are catching your dinner.
You so. remember that restaurant we went to where we had this thing that the guy, the chef desperately wanted us to serve us this fish, but it was too big.
Oh, right.
So he paraded the fish all around the restaurant trying to get someone who would volunteer to buy the rest of it.
That's really great. But it's true, though, when you know, they said catch of the day, and they come around, and here's a dish that's got, you know, three different kinds of fish. None of them are the same. And that was the catch of the day. I mean, that's a term that's basically has lost its meaning in America.
Well, this is one monster fish.
A monster fish. Well,
monster
I don't know if you got takers, but...
Well, I think we finished up eating some of it.
I think so. Well, Eliza, I wish you well in this. I mean, you're broad... outlook on life and broad experience is certainly reflected in the variety of the things you could do making soup in this book. And I guess congratulations is also due because your previous book, Making Artisan Pasta, was just named to Cooking Lights magazine's list of the top 100 cookbooks of the last 25 years.
Yeah,
how about that?
That was pretty great. The last 25 years, I mean, that really made me feel good. Obviously, I think it'll help sales to put a sticker on it, and I think people notice those things. But
I did.
Well, thank you. But I think that with the soups, I just think that it's the right time for this book. That starting in the fall when the weather is starting to get cooler, people are going to be thinking more soup. But in every recipe, I put... what things you can save for scraps, what some things you throw away, because broccoli, anything in the cabbage family really doesn't taste good unless you're making cabbage soup.
Right.
So I list all of them, and then I also talk about freezing, whether it's good to freeze or not. Most of the soups freeze very well, but there are a few of them that either don't freeze well or maybe you freeze the part of it and you have to add the sopa de tortilla that has the tortilla chips and has avocado, you're going to have to put that in fresh. But the soup base that has the chicken and the chilies in it, that freezes very well. So I really wanted it to be very inspiring, but also very down-to-earth and very practical for the home cook.
Sensible. It's a sensible book, but with flair and creativity.
Well, we wish you luck with your soup book.
With your new job.
With your new venture, yeah.
Well, thank you.
And
if you ever come down to Philly, I want you to come visit.
Absolutely. We'll definitely
Where is this, Center City?
No, it's actually in the East Falls area.
Okay.
It's kind of halfway in between. It's the hub of a spoke that goes in all directions. About 15 minutes from Center City, 15 minutes from many of the other suburbs, and in a kind of an up-and-coming area, getting a lot of revitalization.
Oh, good. Yeah. And it's an area that needed it, if I recall correctly. I said it's an area that needed it, if I can recall correctly.
Well, it definitely did. But, the whole city is seeing there's just a lot of energy here now. Lots of people moving in from... Really, a lot of chefs coming in from New York because they can open a restaurant here for just the overnight is so much less. So that has been quite a few areas of the city that are really very interesting right now, and we're very close to the farm, so I'm able to go to the farmer's market, or I can go visit my farmer friends, people that I work with for years, bringing me all kinds of stuff, and very local. Lancaster County is very close by. 25 miles, 20 miles, something like that from here. So we have access to some really wonderful products. But I know Pittsburgh area, I was out there. I don't know if the place is still around, Highhold.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's still there, absolutely.
It's been there forever.
Yeah. I did a special event, a special dinner there with one of my earlier books called The Field Guide to Produce.
Uh-huh.
And that place was, what a story there.
Oh, yeah.
They're still making lobster bisque.
I'll tell you, they did a wonderful job. It was one of the best experiences I've had in doing guest chef, because you never know what you're going to find.
That's true.
I also went to the Washington County State Fair, and I did demos there. So it was a lot of fun.
Anyhow, let me know when you're coming back. Eliza Green, The Soup Maker's Kitchen, and good luck and much success to you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for joining us today at On the Menu. We'll be here same time, same place next week. We hope you will be too. And until
bye-bye.
Then. Oh, yeah. See, I fooled you there. Good. Do your bye-bye again.
Bye-bye.